Hi, and welcome to a new bonus episode of Undisclosed. This week's episode is Men in Blue. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And this week, my colleagues Susan and Colin are not going to be joining me, but that's only because they are really busy getting ready for season two, which, by the way, is right around the corner. It launches July 11th. Now, we've spent the last couple of months highlighting through these bonus episodes an entire host of issues attached to criminal justice, from youth incarceration to wrongful convictions, bipartisan justice from the state level to the U.S. congressional level. We featured people bringing us stories of exonerations and even military justice. But one issue we haven't yet mentioned, a big one, one that has been at the center of media and public scrutiny for the past few years, is police reform. In many ways, it all starts with the police on the ground. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell our listeners about a brand new sponsor we have this week, which we are really excited about, not only because they are a really cool sponsor, but also because it's really important that our listeners understand that we couldn't bring you week after week the content that we are bringing you, the work that we're putting in, without the sponsors. Our sponsors are part of the Undisclosed family. So I really hope that all our listeners take advantage of the kinds of deals that they bring to you and the kinds of amazing products that they offer. Having said all that, I'm bringing in our executive producer, Dennis Robinson, the man behind the Undisclosed Machine, to talk to us about the new sponsor, because it kind of made sense to have him talk about it. Our new sponsor is Mack Weldon Men's Underwear. All right, Dennis, when this sponsor first came to us, I was like, look, I'm a woman. I've never heard of this underwear. I'll be honest. And the first thing you said was, I love them. I live by them. Can you explain?
I didn't say I live by them. I said I've been wearing them for a few years, and I have. They're wonderful.
And so we were really lucky because our sponsor, Mack Weldon, allowed me and Susan and Colin to get some for ourselves so we could try it out, of course. I was not trying them out, but my husband did.
What did he think?
Today I asked him how it felt after giving him a few days. And I'll be honest, my husband loves undershirts. He lives for undershirts. I've never seen a man with so many undershirts in my life. So the undershirts were amazing for him. He talked about things like contour and draping. He's never felt fabric like that. Yeah, he loves the stuff.
That's like a little secret that guys don't like to tell anybody, but we need to be comfortable in good undershirts, good underwear, good socks. That's really, really important to us. I've been wearing Mack Weldon for, I don't know, a couple years now, and I do almost everything in Mack Weldon. I work out, I wear the socks. Everything just feels amazing. And it's mostly because the design is just really smart and the fabrics are premium and it feels amazing. And the other thing that just makes it so much better than typical underwear is that the shopping experience on the website is so simple. I despise going to like a big chain store, grabbing a 3-pack of underwear and having to wait in line. With Mack Weldon, you don't have to worry about any of that. The site is really streamlined. The designs are right there and they look great and they're easy to pick out. I just love it. It makes it that much easier to buy something that feels great when you wear it.
Yeah, you know, I actually was with my hubby as we were browsing online. You're right, they have a really clean site. It was really easy for him to pick out what he wanted. And what's amazing with this fabric is that it's actually antimicrobial. You know, it means it eliminates odor. Guys, pay attention. It eliminates odor. But the other thing was he couldn't figure out what he wanted because it wasn't just underwear. You know, they've got socks, they've got the hoodies and sweatpants. They've got a really great array of products that they offer.
Yeah, I dig it. And the best part is that anybody that's listening to this right now, you can go to mackweldon.com, and if you use promo code undisclosed, you're going to get 20% off of your offer. I think everybody should go there, get something for yourself, get something for your hubby, your boyfriend, make them feel comfortable, you know, get them some good workout clothes, some good socks they can wear, and make sure that when you go to get it at mackweldon.com, use promo code undisclosed.
And they'll smell great too. Mm. There you go. Okay, so back to our episode. This week, it's a real pleasure for me to have someone on the show who I consider a friend and someone I also consider a very inspirational person, and that is Michael Wood. Michael is an ex-Marine and retired Baltimore City police sergeant who became a nationally known figure when he began sharing on social media some of the terrible things that he had witnessed in his 11 years on the streets of Baltimore. Hi, Michael. Good morning, and thanks for joining us on Undisclosed.
Thanks for having me as always, Robbie. I'm always proud to, and I don't know, I feel helpful from time to time, and I really care about what happens with a nod. So
you are more than helpful. You've been an incredible source of support. And, you know, you first came to my attention, like you did for the entire nation, about a year ago, I think. It was June 2015. You, like, exploded on the national scene. And I was like, everybody's talking about this ex-cop in Baltimore who's, like, tweeting what he saw for 11 years. After that, I think when we connected about Adnan, I was just, like, floored. I was like, I cannot believe he's putting his credibility, his name on the line to support us with Adnan's case. So, and it still means a lot to me. It really does.
Thanks. I want to see Adnan. I want to see justice.
So I want to orient people a little bit about what was going on a year ago. This happened just a few months after Freddie Gray, a young man named Freddie Gray, who most people should be familiar with, was arrested and then died in police custody. A couple of months after that, you just, and I assume you were on Twitter before that. Can you tell us kind of what precipitated that? Like all of a sudden, and you, how long were you with the Baltimore City Police?
I joined in 2004.
And how long were you with them?
2003. Look at me. I don't even know how long ago. That's what happens. That's what policing does to you. So
I know you're
in January of 2003.
Well, I know it's like a really early morning for you because you're on the West Coast. So thanks for doing that. But you joined in 2003 and you were with them until?
January of 2014.
Did you work in a particular division?
When I started off, coincidentally, the first assignment I had was walking foot patrol as a rookie officer in the very neighborhood Freddie Gray was arrested in, over in Gilmore Homes. And then I went into regular patrol, went out of that into narcotics, to what is known for people that watch The Wire as knockers or jump out boys or something like that. So you do street enforcement. And then from that, I was, I guess, good enough at that, that I went to the major case squad and was the youngest violent crime major case squad detective. Got promoted out of there and went to the Eastern. And then I spent some time in headquarters after being injured and seeing the inside of the department there.
Did you resign or did you retire? How did you leave the force?
That injury is why I was out. So a lot of the misconception a lot of people had is they think that I had some kind of moral or ethical awakening and quit. And I certainly didn't. I didn't either bring down the wall willingly or, you know, consciously or subconsciously until I like had that safety net and could step back.
So in 2014 is then, I think, that's 11 years, right? I mean, like, is when you left. And it was about a year later that these infamous tweets happened. So can you walk us through, like, how this happened? I mean, this is very rare for an ex-cop to suddenly become kind of a whistleblower, just go public with the kinds of things they've seen. Like, what precipitated that?
Well, I guess we have to give some credit to, like, social media and the cell phone cameras. Even I had that bit of denial in me of how bad things were. I would see, you know, I saw Mike Brown be killed in Ferguson, and you see the response and how the state's attorneys react, and you think, like, okay, so you're still thinking that's a bad apple, like that's somewhere else. And then when I saw Tamir Rice be murdered, and the district attorneys and the police and the police unions there were acting like nothing was wrong and it was okay. Like this guy that should never be a cop gunned down a 12-year-old boy and watched him bleed to death like he had shot a deer. Like, I emotionally, I couldn't, like, I don't know if I can still get over that video. I still was thinking, okay, it's not them. You know, maybe Cleveland's racist, but, you know, Baltimore's a black city with a black police department, with a black mayor, black police commissioner, all these things. It's like, I'm still separating it for some reason.
Well, let me just ask you about that, because that's interesting to me. I actually assumed, because, you know, I mean, having read your tweets and heard about your experiences, which I'm going to want you to talk about a little bit for our listeners, that you would have seen that and recognized it as, yeah, that's exactly what I've seen in my career, not be so removed from it. So I'm kind of surprised about that.
I mean, there's a level of cognitive dissonance and denial that this is what all police are going through. You're indoctrinated into this culture, and you're just not seeing beyond this. There's this consequential ethics overall idea in policing that ultimately what we do is good for people. So the gray area isn't so bad to dwell into. So for some reason, it just, I don't know, you're a pawn in the system and you don't think about it. And that's a shitty excuse, but it's true. So then with Freddie Gray, So I know why they're chasing him down. You know, they're trying to get stats. So
they're trying to get what?
Statistics, you know, their arrest quotas. And they're just trying to please the bosses.
Yep.
So when he does that group of occupiers, because I did feel like an occupier, they come in and they chase this man down and they put him in a metal box as an authority of the state, and they take him out of that metal box dead, and they want to say, we don't have anything to do with this, or this is just unfortunate. And it's like, this isn't policing. This isn't how life goes. You can't sit there and say that you can take a man's freedom away and kill him and bear no responsibility. Like, I don't know. It doesn't matter how this goes down. You're responsible. You were he was in a charge of your custody, just like, you know, a child would be in the social services system. You were responsible for that individual. So the idea that it was finally home and that we were shedding all accountability and responsibility for what was obvious was like the logical end for me. I was like, that's it. If we can do this, then we can, as you know, if my friends and the people that I know can do this, then obviously anybody can do this, and that has to stop.
So that's what then you decided, that as this was being scrutinized, you know, around the country about what happened with Freddie Gray and how could this happen, and at the same time you still have, you know, the police department kind of not taking responsibility, you just kind of had it and you just decided, I'm going to share my personal experience with the world.
Right, because I can't talk about it without admitting my fault, right? So I think maybe that's why you have hesitation and things too, is the only way to discuss this was to say that I did bad things and I was screwed up and I was wrong just as much as everybody else by turning a blind eye to things.
After you retired, I'm assuming you still maintain relationships with folks in the force, and I'm sure you have a social circle that has a lot of former and current cops in it. Did you think about those relationships as you went to the world, about your experience and what that would do?
No. I mean, it was really a final, you know, straw that broke the camel's back, that I didn't care anymore, because we were, it's just like the visual evidence is right there. Like when you see Michael Slager killing in South Carolina, when you see that cop Slager kill and then the other cop cover it up, it's just like this evidence is everywhere. And you're like, it doesn't matter what these relationships are. This is, we have to stop.
Did that impact your relationships? What happened? How did other cops react to this?
Well, I mean,
you talk about a culture, right? And we always think about it like a band of brothers type of thing. This is so rare for this to happen. So there had to be some blowback for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm out, you know, like I'm considered a traitor. I have two friends that are still in that I talk to. But other than that, they all think I like betrayed the brotherhood. They don't even argue the merits of the point. The offense is that I turned on them as, and didn't even name any names. Actually, I'm not a whistleblower because I didn't snitch on anybody individual.
Right.
So, like, I didn't even harm them, but still that betrayal of the thin blue line or that brotherhood makes it so that, you know, I'm the enemy.
Can we talk a little bit about what you, and, you know, of course, I'm pretty interested in what goes on in Baltimore City, especially because of its connection to Adnan's case, but really the focus of the country, and when it comes to police reform issues, it's one of the major kind of hubs and focal points of issues on police reform. So in your 11 years, can you kind of tell us some of the things you witnessed? I mean, are we talking about just like egregious abuse? Are we talking about corruption? What kinds of things were you having to witness and just piled up in your consciousness?
For some reason, the more egregious things are done by other people, so we don't really think about them. But one of the biggest ones that people, they are sensationalized, so people do think about, the things that people don't think about, I want to talk about, are the things that, like, I literally did and were my practices. So you're pushed for statistics, and you're pushed to get those arrest numbers, and there's things like multiple felonies that you pile up to get mandatory sentencing and things like that. So when I was a major case detective, what we were doing and what I was doing, considering I was the lead writer, is we would go and say I saw somebody that was a target. I would watch them commit an offense, and like something like driving down the street with a suspended license or doing a drug deal, whatever it was. And I would get a warrant on them and then hold on to it. and then watch them do something else and get a warrant and hold on to it. And did that for months, where so that I ended up having like five or six multiple cases. And instead of enforcing at the time, you let them pile up, you take them to court, and you put all those down, and you end up having multiple cases. So if you get guilties for each one, then it looks like they have all these past prior offenses, and the judges treat them more harshly, even though it was like this continuing chain of events that I never broke up.
Well, okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. There are going to be citizens who say, so what? If this person is continuing to commit, you know, whatever, they're breaking the law, whether it's small offenses, bigger offenses, you know, each time you're getting that warrant for something they actually did. It's not like you're planting evidence or making it up.
Right, but I am intentionally manipulating a system that had good intent. So the good intent of that law is that somebody would commit some heavy offense, get prosecuted, get incarcerated, and they didn't fix themselves, so they got out, and you're kind of having a harsher sentence in theory because they had a period of recidivism and didn't actually become a member of society. But these are people that didn't even have the chance to get into the system and have, like, we know the system is not going to help anybody. We're talking about the theory behind it, right? Even violating its intent.
I understand what you're saying, kind of like on a, you know, 30,000 foot scale, and how this all systematically ends up looking like communities where you have so many men who have been locked up for long periods of time. But I do want to still push back, because I know on the other side, you're going to have people who are like, look, we have to be tough on crime. Crime is an issue, especially in urban centers. And what is the role of the police if they're not going to do this and put these people away for the kind of times that they deserve?
Well, that's a fundamental question, and maybe where I go too liberal, but this is where I get from being a researcher in this subject, is that you're fundamentally having that idea, and even though you're pushing back from a legitimate question, what that question is predicated upon is punishment. And people think of it that way, and it's hard to get over not thinking about it that way. We think that way from our culture and from the rhetoric that we've heard since the war on drugs started, that we are supposed to be tough and we are supposed to be punitive on them. But that is not the goal. The goal is supposed to be to fix them, to get them back into society as a productive member. When you violate that intent, there's a moral element that we're passing by in policing, that of service. I'm supposed to be serving that individual as well. So that person that I kept doing that for, I was doing the exact opposite of service. I was essentially burying him legally.
That person you're supposed to be serving, how does it end up that you are burying him instead? How do you decide this is the person I'm going to like rack up the warrants against?
So this is the same violent repeat offender program that you'll see a lot in a lot of other cities. We were doing it in Baltimore at that time, and the main purpose of our unit, my entire squad, was dedicated to having a list of the top 10 violent repeat offenders who are just like predicted, or they think are going to get into something. They're doing it in Chicago now, doing it in Baltimore now. And then your commander will just assign you a name, and you start at the top of that list. And you go out and you start conducting surveillance and piling up charges on the individual. I mean, they were just a name on a list to me when it starts.
So wait a minute, are these lists based, you use the word predictive, are these lists based on like past offenses or some other kinds of predictors, like some kind of algorithm?
Whoever does it in criminal intel, they're not going to have some kind of sophisticated algorithm. They're going to look at what the past offenses are, who their associates are. They might get some intel from other cases that there's looking for retribution or a comeback shooting. So there's a lot of different models that they have. There are some companies that do algorithms. I don't believe Baltimore was doing it. But however it is, it's relatively easy to see. You're going to end up with these people with more prior past offenses and associates that are also involved in police attention in one way, shape, or form. The problem is that police attention, when it starts, is a very odd thing in a place like Baltimore, because you're constantly being focused on. So it's so easy to look like something you're not.
You know, one thing I haven't mentioned this yet, and I think it's like the big elephant in the room here, is that what those lists end up looking like, and what these communities end up looking like, and that's race. Yeah. Is that something that is consciously or not consciously a predictor, an issue? Like, how does race factor into all of this? I know in Baltimore, obviously, it's a highly black city, a lot of people of color, but you also have a force that looks like that, too. Can you talk about the issue of race and how it impacts policing?
So officially, you're never going to see race as an element. It comes as the result of implicit bias that we all have. I think it was worse before and less now, but you have these things in culture that tells you that the black male is more aggressive, and that comes out through movies. We've proven scientifically that people think that black males are about 4 years older than they are, and they're heavier and bigger. You saw that with Tamir Rice and the way they described him. So you get these cultural things in you that form up implicit biases, and they don't realize them. So those implicit biases make people seem like others. And that's going to be different for everybody and everywhere. I usually attribute it to factors. So if you're a black male, you have the black factor. If you are a black female, then you are not only black, but you're also a female, which has discrimination. If you're a black female Muslim in this country right now, I don't know how you can do much, because you're really piling up the factors in the rhetoric and the way we go about things in people's subconscious. And that's a huge concern right now, because it's been recognized and police departments are trying to change for that. But what the message that ends up getting across is that cops think, oh, you're right, that I just thought black and brown people were dangerous. You're right, white people are dangerous too, instead of realizing that, no, the black and brown people also aren't dangerous. It's a very tough issue for those implicit things. And internally within, you don't see overt racism in the police department. It's not there. But what that implicit bias string does, and intentionally focusing cops in certain areas, is you view them as others. So you go in, and when you're told, we have to get arrest numbers from management, you have to get all these things, you need to put people in jail. Well, I think in the back of your mind, people don't want to put people that they understand with or they're compassionate with in jail, obviously. So you go after those others that we've already had programmed into us from our surroundings, or others, or the bad ones. It's not like a conscious reaction. That is why you can have a black officer who has actions that are just as racist, if not more, than anyone else, because it's this thing that's under the surface.
No, I get that. I mean, these are like, especially in the last couple of years, I've been really doing a lot of reading and research on human biases and cognitive biases and how they impact the criminal justice system. And they impact it from policing to prosecution all the way down the line, sentencing, and even, after people have served their time. And it's really a really difficult thing to tackle and figure out how to counter that. I want to ask you something, because, you know, obviously, we know, especially in the large cities, the bigger cities get a lot of scrutiny, or are getting more scrutiny in the last few years. And you talked a little bit about like how you were programmed on a daily basis just to kind of do your work in a way that ended up really harming communities. You didn't mention like some of the more like the kinds of violent abuses that have been captured on camera and stuff. But two questions. The first is this. Is the kind of behavior you witnessed in Baltimore, can we assume that this is happening in just like a lot of large cities, or is this kind of like become the police culture everywhere, like even in small towns? Because I can't accept that everybody in the system is somebody who is like, you know, corrupt or angry or abusive. There are good people in the system. There are great people who are cops. How do they engage this? What happens here? How do they not act as a wall to all this?
I think the most surprising promise that I've had, even though I've certainly made a lot of enemies in policing, is that my email inbox is full of cops around this country who recognize the exact same problems and do want to help and do want to try and figure out how they can do it. So I think it does go everywhere, because these cops are from everywhere. And I don't see any reason to believe that it's not everywhere, because it is that culture. I mean, these same things that we're getting ingrained with. When I say I was brainwashed, or that's not even going to say brainwashed, just say like incentivized, you know, it's just you're just encouraged to go about this route. That I was encouraged from this route from being 17. I was a poor kid that lived in Section 8, And our country's solution to how I can get a stepping stone was to take a 17-year-old and train him to be a killer in the Marine Corps. And then immediately after that, rule-following, rah-rah America, go into policing because my skills didn't really transfer anywhere else, even though I did want to do it, but that was my skill set, that you're throwing away everything that you've, like, that's your identity, that this culture and system of America brought you into. And once we recognize that, then we can start fixing it. So I think we're still in this period of denial where we have to get more cops to listen and to understand what's going on, but we will fix it, because really what it just takes is it takes finally somebody like me to get an agency or to get a politician that recognizes these things and really implements the change. I don't think it's super complicated. I really think it's just a management issue where you start incentivizing officers to do the things that the citizens actually want them to do. And for that, citizens need to direct the police department and figure out where they want their agency to go and do things. We have implicit biases in others because we can't extend beyond our tribalism of maybe knowing 100 to 150 people because we're a tribal creature. But if we have civilians on a board controlling things, they're not going to come up with ideas like we should lock up Susie's daughter because she has a dime bag in her pocket. That's not going to happen. That's the only thing I can see for perpetual policing model that will continue to adapt with society, is that it must become civilian led. In America, policing is always told you what it will be. It has never asked you.
You've mentioned a couple of things that I've been thinking about, like, you know, what is the model of change here? Is it ground up? Is it going to be, you know, regular cops saying, like, we do not want to engage the people we serve like this? Is it trickle down, you know, or is it the community? And it sounds like it's a little bit of all of it, right? I mean, to make real changes in the entire system, the cultural shifts.
I think revolution's ground up. So you do have to have the base that makes the change. I think you have multiple factors of going about this. If we can maybe overturn Citizens United, get money out of politics, you can just have one politician that finally has enough courage to go with something like that and test the model, because they feel risky. They want to stay conservative into the what everyone expects. So you'll need a revolutionary and progressive politician to do it, or the people will force the change. I try to encourage people to force the change. We have Oakland and San Francisco right now who need chiefs, and I have people from Oakland and San Francisco saying, what can we do? And I can only tell them the same thing. You must make your voice heard. You must demand, you know, if you want me to be your chief, you have to demand it, and then we can go about making these changes. The only way it's going to be is if the people demand it.
You mentioned that the police have always told people this is the way it's going to be. And it's interesting because when I was growing up, to me, the police were like Andy Griffith and Barney Fife. I grew up in small town America. And obviously, as a kid, you know, it's not like I'm going to have a lot of interaction with police. I certainly had no idea what was happening in like large urban communities. But don't you think, I mean, I feel like in the last 50, 60, 70 years, there has been a steady militarization of the police, and it's not necessarily that police have always been the way they are today?
Well, this happened in the 80s, at the start of the drug war, and then really took off in the North Hollywood shooting. That was a bank shootout where they had the heavily armed robbery suspects, and the police were outgunned. And at that point in time, what police started saying is that the answer wasn't to make sure that bank robbers didn't have body armor or semi-automatic weapons. The answer was that police needed bigger body armor and bigger automatic weapons. And that went really nicely with our war machine, who was having excess equipment that they didn't know what to do with.
This actually takes me to an issue that's not directly tied to, well, maybe it is. I mean, and that is really the Orlando shooting and kind of what it signifies. And I know, as someone who follows these issues, this one is getting a lot of attention, but it's not like mass shootings don't happen every single day. They actually do. And the issue of gun control. The more I think about this, and as somebody obviously who comes from the Muslim community, you know, I understand all the different politics behind it, terrorism, immigration. There's just so many things that are connected on this issue. But I feel like whether you're talking about an inner city shootout or, you know, someone like Umar Mateen or a kid who accidentally shoots his sister in the face, it kind of boils down to this common denominator of having access to guns. Where do you stand on this issue, and how significant do you think it is, like, across the board of, like, the issue of gun violence in this country?
When it comes to gun control, I am somebody that started off in the Marine Corps and in the police department, so I was as pro-gun as I guess a typical American in this country would be. I had them. I trained with them every day. That was my life skill. Over time of seeing things in reality and getting an education, the numbers are just staggering that this is obviously the wrong path. I can't say that I have all the solutions, but what I can say is that what we know for sure is the path that we're going on, the Orlando shooting, 102 casualties, is only a temporary placeholder for the bigger and better shooting that somebody goes out there and does and gets bigger and better weapons to do. So we have to stop doing this path. There's just no way around it. The compromise that I'm thinking is that maybe if it's home defense, then have as many shotguns as you want. I don't care. Have as many bolt-action rifles as you want. Whatever this mission you want to achieve in what is American culture now, you can achieve with all those things. But concealed handguns are causing 30,000 deaths a year in this country, or at least the vehicle for that death, and make it much easier to do. And then you have the semi-automatic rifles, like the Bundys who were pointing weapons at federal agents. You have all these things going on, and you have to stop these things. We're the developed country that has the worst homicide rates with death. I mean, we're doing it the worst way you could possibly do it. The idea that we defend our position when it is empirically the worst position doesn't make any sense. We have a huge level of cognitive dissonance on gun control.
The other thing a lot of people don't, I think, really think about it in this way is just how we compare to other Western nations, you know, on this issue. And even if you want to pull in the issue of terrorism, urban violence, I mean, obviously any developed Western nation is dealing with all of these issues, but there is a vast difference between the numbers and gun deaths in these countries and the United States. I mean, we can just cross the border and go north. In Canada, it's a whole different scenario.
Right. I mean, and why are cops shooting people despite cameras being everywhere? Because they think they all have guns, whether they have cell phones or a thing of chapstick. Cops are running around afraid that everyone has guns. And then our solution is that everyone has more guns? It's ridiculousness. I think the first thing we have to do is to stop making them. How can you keep making something that we have more of than people? We wouldn't keep making houses that, you know, if we had 300 million people, we're not going to go out and make 500 million houses, are we?
Yeah, I mean, I read the other day that there are more gun shops in the country than there are McDonald's and Starbucks combined. And
that,
so it's really mind-blowing. You said something that I kind of didn't think about before, which is that, you know, cops are shooting people because they think they have guns. I thought that cops are shooting people and beating up people and choking people to death on camera because there's no accountability and they know they're going to get away with it.
Two separate groups there. So you have the aggressive knocker cops like I was who, yeah, that's the...
What does that mean? What's a knocker cop?
So that's the jump out boys. If people watch The Wires, you're just like street enforcing. Like you're the regulator on the street. You're making sure people aren't on corners. You're going after minor drug offenders, chasing people around, jumping out on them. Essentially, I mean, the jump out boys is a pretty accurate way of thinking about it.
Okay, so you're saying you have those folks and then you have different groups here.
Yeah, the scared. So you're going to see those shootings where somebody's standing there and there's a naked man and he just looks scary and they shoot him. And so that's your fear. Like Keith Davis Jr. has a cell phone in his hand in Baltimore and they shoot him. And you had that happen in New York. You have it happen all over the place. So you have that fear element there and then you have the over-aggressive element. There's very different types of cops. The really lazy ones aren't likely to get in your situation, so you're inadequately trained, or scared ones may get into that situation but then don't know how to get out. And you have the other aggressive side that kind of intentionally puts themselves into that situation and then relies on the law that has extreme levels of protection for police to just say, I was afraid, and can do whatever they want.
So you think the accountability issue is that this gives police just a pass saying that I was afraid the suspect had something in their hand, and that's enough. I mean, what happens to police in that situation? We know that right now we have the Freddie Gray trials happening. But more often than not, what happens internally in a police department? Do they get demoted, do they get suspended, lose their jobs? What are we talking about here?
Well, no, I mean, pretty much anyone that pulls a trigger is treated as a hero. They're going to get awards and everything else. So that's incentivized. And at no point in time of anything that I've ever talked about that we did I have the slightest connotation that any of us were going to get caught at this by IID. That was the internal investigation wasn't going to get you. So you had no disincentive. So if human beings are being pushed to do something and have no barriers in the way of doing that, it's almost a human thing or something we at least can't regulate. That's the thing with gun control, too. There's a bit of a parallel there that we say, oh, guns don't shoot people, people shoot people. Yeah, I mean, that's right. And it's like people do evil things when they have power. So you have to keep people from having guns to easily kill people, just as you have to keep checks and balances on power so that it doesn't go astray. These are like things that were written down in, you know, the 12th century of how power corrupts absolutely.
You went and got your master's degree, right? Was it after you left the police force or while you were still serving?
Did my bachelor's when I was in the police department, then did my master's as soon as I got out.
Are you working on a PhD? I don't know why I thought I heard that too.
Yeah, I'm about a year away from my PhD now. That's what I do now.
And the reason I'm asking this is I want to know, who is the average police officer that we run into? Is recruitment done from people who are like well-educated people? Does that have an impact? I mean, I know we had a conversation maybe a while ago on training issues and the kind of folks who are brought into the force. I think, you know, your human resources, what you're dealing with, makes a big difference too.
One problem that we have is example that like Kevin Davis in Baltimore seems to be completely oblivious to, that we've had to try and get him to understand, is what he is saying is like the activism community is pushing for cops to be from the neighborhoods or to look like their neighborhoods, which I mean, we can argue the validity.
And
of
who
that,
is Kevin Davis? Just could you tell
the
us?
The commissioner of Baltimore Police Department now. And what he is doing is he's saying that they can't hire people from the local community because they have a lot of arrests and minor offenses and stuff on their record, while he's sending his current officers that are from the county to go arrest those people and give them those minor records. And then we have the just legality and the paperwork aspect of police being hired, and we do things like polygraphs. So a polygraph isn't admissible in court because you know it's junk, but it's used as a hiring tool to see if someone is anxious. This is what really a polygraph does, is it measures anxiousness. And then in a hiring process for policing, you end up with only three type of people when it comes to the polygraph. You end up with people that never did anything in their life and are completely naive, so they never did do anything wrong. You end up with people that fail the polygraph because they did minor offenses and they feel super guilty about it. So their anxiety is always up about it. And then you have people that can just outright lie on a polygraph and it won't be a problem. So you end up with those two extremes, and those two extremes transcend throughout. The vast majority of your cops, they just want to do their job and not think about it and go home and not bother anybody and get a good paycheck. And then there's a smaller, I don't know, 10 to 20% that is aggressive and wants to go out into the street and chase the bad guys. And that can be well-intentioned too. But those people are going to come from the group that is able to lie on a polygraph because they're prioritizing their desire to get the job, or they don't care about the bad things they did and they lack empathy. So if you lack empathy, caring about what you did, and you're aggressive, then you're going to end up in those aggressive units going out after people, and you don't have so much internally checking and balancing.
You mentioned a couple of times that mostly these are police officers who are well-intentioned. They believe they're getting the right people. They're cleaning up the community, even if they have to bend the rules to some extent. You talked about like this practice of like racking up warrants, which, you know, okay, it's not great, but it's also not something that I would lose sleep over necessarily. What I would lose sleep over, and of course I'm asking specifically, not just because of Nan's case, but a series of cases that I've just been following coming out of Baltimore, is where you have police either manipulating witnesses or coercing them to make certain kinds of statements or even planting evidence. And you're dealing with cops who like think this is definitely the person, you know, who did it. We just don't have what we need, so we want to do this. I am going to assume that that's not the 10 to 20% of hyper aggressive people you're talking about. Is that a fairly common, like something that people would not blink at in force?
You can't deny how common it is. We have a society that praises anti-intellectualism and teaches people our moral metric is, was it legal? None of those things are the right thing or are talking about justice when this system is supposed to fundamentally be justice. So as long as in our whole society we have this idea that cops go out and get bad guys and they put them in jail and they lock them away and we don't want to talk about people who think about it and to really analyze it, like they're going to dismiss this conversation that we're having as some kind of liberal thing that we want to hug the prisoners. It goes out and it transcends into those implicit biases that people have even when it comes to their perspective on the world and how they're going to go about their jobs. I really struggle whether they're like consciously aware of somebody like in Nod's case where they found that narrative and then everything they do is twisted into getting into that narrative, and they think consequentially they're doing the right thing. And often because this guy has like a past criminal record, and that criminal record gets there through those messed up means that I talk about, or somebody like Adnan, who you have the factors of discrimination against, and that's easy to, when you see them as others, take it out on them. So as a society as a whole, we have to start embracing our diversity and really just getting out of this racist history we have.
Before we move on to the rest of the interview, I do want to talk a little bit about one of our sponsors who's been with us really for the past year, and that is The Great Courses. I've talked about The Great Courses before. I've taken a number of their courses, and I talked about this just last week, in fact, about one of the courses that they offer, The Fundamentals of Photography. As an aspiring journalist and photographer back in high school, I wasn't ever really able to fulfill that ambition to go pro. But thankfully, with this course from The Great Courses, The Fundamentals of Photography, I've really upped my game. This particular course is taught by a professional photographer and National Geographic fellow, and you know, like me, National Geographic is known for their photography, Joel Sartore. And, you know, he offered some amazing tips and tools to not just take better pictures, but make your amateur shots look professional. You get advice on lighting and framing and perspectives. And again, I'm going to point to my cat pictures, my Mr. Bean pictures on Twitter, which you can easily find, to prove how good I've gotten after this course. Now, The Great Courses, of course, doesn't just offer photography courses. It offers thousands and thousands of courses, over 7,000 video lectures on their Great Courses Plus video learning service. I know a lot of you who listen to Undisclosed are people who love to learn, love to expand their skill sets, love to consume information. You're going to find everything there. History, science, art, how to do things, how to build things, how to understand things. I know lots of our listeners have taken some of these courses, and I would actually love to hear back from you guys. Tweet at us. Tell us what courses you took and what you really liked, and make some recommendations, because I'd like to check them out too. So if you are an undisclosed listener, you have a great offer coming your way from The Great Courses. You can sign up today as one of our listeners, and you'll immediately get 1 month free to start watching as many lectures streaming online as you want. Make sure to check out the course that I took, Fundamentals of Photography, but also check out all the others. Start your free trial today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Let me say that again. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Looking forward to hearing about everything you've learned. This is an issue that I think about a lot too and struggle with, is what does justice mean? Does it mean following the letter of the law? And if that means people who are culpable, who are criminals, they get to walk because you follow the letter of the law? Or does it mean getting the right people at any cost? And I've heard this specifically a lot from cops. I think I've even had an argument with you about it. You're like, well, you know, their intentions are good. I don't care about your intentions. What you're doing is illegal and unethical. If you think it's the right person, but you're like going about it in the shadiest way to get them, you're breaking the law.
Let's win the argument. You're 100% right. So I'm stuck in this position of how do I fix it?
Right. How do you fix it?
And I'm not going to be able to kick a whole police department out and start from scratch. So I have to think about what is going on in their head.
Like, how do you fix it? What are the kinds of solutions? And I know you applied for a position in Chicago. What was the position?
For superintendent,
Superintendent of police, okay. You have a lot of ideas, and you are like one of the most vocal activists on the issue of police reform. I want to hear some of your ideas. If you were to become commissioner of the police in Chicago, what would you have done?
Well, that is super, super broad for a very complicated and nuanced topic that we'd have to break down.
You've got 30 seconds.
for each second, I mean, my Chicago application is 38 pages in itself. But when it comes to how we address the corruption, we fundamentally have to keep people close to getting caught. In the literature, scientific literature, the only place that like a broken windows type mentality works on crime is actually against the police, where you have to have this idea that no matter what happens, you're very close to getting caught. Right now, there's no closeness to getting caught. So I can't change their minds and I can't change how they think. What I'm concerned about is changing how they act. And how they act will be dependent upon making legislation and policy understanding how they think. It gets quite complicated, but if they're close to being caught, which would mean we need something like an anonymous reporting system where officers can report things to an actual investigative authority who can put the brakes on corruption as it's going on. So think if there's a young rookie officer and he's seeing somebody be arrested or abused for something, he doesn't have to go the Joey Crystal route and put himself out there and ruin his career. What he instead can do is make like a system where you have an anonymous reporting, maybe it's in the covert background of all the computers that everybody knows you can do this, and you can talk about it and someone can interrupt the process before the suspect has the fallout from their actions. And we can address and get rid of a bad officer while incentivizing the easy reporting method. And we have to incentivize as a culture that we don't tolerate this. It has to be a whole broad perspective that we change policing into a profession instead of a hobby or something, which is essentially what it is. Cops, as long as they're going to be GEDs that you send to a six-month academy and just treat them to follow the letter of the law, they're going to end up being pawns. You intentionally created a pawn. I want to create thinkers. So it's more of a philosophy of getting people throughout the entire training system to think instead of just doing.
That seems like a really simple fix. I mean, an anonymous reporting system. And I think what surprises me is that you seem to be suggesting there isn't one.
There isn't one. And some actual private agencies have talked to me about trying to start that up, but you have to have an agency that's willing to do it and take it seriously. The infrastructure is actually already done because other people have had this idea. It's just a matter of the departments implementing it. It's not rocket science. Like I was saying earlier with the internal investigations detectives, for instance, in Baltimore, they're going to be, to a certain extent, and I don't mean to insult them personally, but they're going to be your lower skilled detectives. Because for one, they're considered like the rat squad and all that stuff. So there's a stigma on it. And there's no detective test in Baltimore. So those are the people that are picked. So
Wait. There's no detective test? How do you become detective?
No. Somebody tells you you're a detective.
That explains a lot. Okay.
So you just get the job. So you become an officer, for instance, and you'll get assigned to the shooting squad or burglary squad. And then you're a detective. That's the way it works then.
That's really problematic. I didn't know that. I always assumed that in any, especially large city, the process to become a detective would be much more rigorous instead of having no process at all. I want to shift focuses a little bit about something that maybe our listeners don't know about, and that is your involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement, which, you know, as somebody who's, you're a white guy, former Marine, former cop, not an easy thing to do. How did that happen, and what is kind of your role with local activists?
I think once I realized I had to speak out, I also recognized that one of the changing elements within myself was when I was about halfway through my career. I volunteered, it's called volunteering, but it was really forced volunteering at a rec center. And I'm meeting a lot of the kids there. It kind of changed things because I went into it with a negative attitude, thinking I didn't want to be around all the city kids, you know, volunteering for something. But immediately it was great. It was wonderful. It was almost life-changing to the fact that I saw that these kids that were right here, as I was playing with them and having fun, and we did these things for weeks, that 5 years from now, I mean, 10 years from now, if he was on a corner or she was, you know, doing something, that I would have a dramatically different approach to them. I would be dramatically different if another officer approached them in an aggressive manner. I would be defensive of them. So combining with that and speaking out, it was like, well, the only solution for me is to actually learn. Like, what it is I don't know the city. I'm that kind of cop that you know the wire vision, but you don't know the full city and like what to do. So if I'm going to say what to do, I need to really know what people need. That led me into making contact with Black Lives Matter and other police reform activists in Baltimore. And I mean, shockingly, they have set a bar that was to make sure I was true. So let's say they've tested me plenty of times. But once they understood that I was loyal and I really wanted to learn and I was there for them, I've been dramatically impressed about how I've been embraced by the activism community and worked together towards figuring out how these things are. If I'm going to be a chief or write down suggestions or even talk about this, I need to understand what the people actually want. And so they've really taught me a lot about how we're going to do these reform measures and what the problems have been, which should have been obvious. When we talk about helping these cities, we're talking about what we're going to do to them, and we're talking about what they're going to give them. We're never saying, what do you need us to do to help you? And that's the fundamental mess up that we're having all throughout, whether it's policing or how we address a hyper-segregated community.
So then what have you learned? What are the priorities for Black Lives Matter in Baltimore? I know in different cities there'll be different priorities, but on a local level, what are the signals that are coming to you that these are the things that we want changes on first and most importantly?
I think fundamentally the movement and Black Lives Matter really encompasses multiple movements, that the idea isn't unified. The idea is really that we are a community and we all have input and come together and figure out what our solutions are. And if you come to them with an honest approach all the way around as a community, that's where you find your answers. And that is where the nuance is into what and how you approach it. Like an overall crime plan will work good for a city, but each individual neighborhood will need different resources and different ways to get out of the causations of crime, because that's another rabbit hole we'll go down to, is I want to fundamentally change policing to fight causes and not symptoms of crime. The other biggest lesson I've learned from the activism community in Baltimore is that I know I had to make myself vulnerable and had to really hear them, even though they were going to be angry about things that I did and things that I covered up, things that policing do in general, and things that have happened to them are going to vicariously come against me. And so we've had these really open conversations and sessions where we let our guards down and really get to the roots of issues. And what's really dramatically affected me is that cops don't see the results of the process.
Right.
Being in the movement, I've seen the lives that were affected. So when somebody's wrongly incarcerated for 3 years, what that does to them is dramatic. And the amount of lives that are affected from the corruption of our criminal justice system, I think if cops saw that, when you're ready to throw Freddie Gray in that back of that van, I think you take a fundamentally different approach and try to figure out how Freddie Gray got there instead of figuring out how you're going to put him in a cell instead.
I know that there are town halls and liaison groups and community police interaction, but it seems like what you're talking about is a different level of intimacy between police officers and the community, and not one that's kind of like a formal meeting. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it can't be formal. It has to be integration, not occupation. So,
you know, that's the second time you brought up that word. And, you know, when you say occupation, it has a whole different connotation for a lot of people. And you know what I'm talking about, right?
No.
So occupation to me, as somebody who's been an activist for 2 decades, like on other kinds of issues, really signals the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I know there are
I didn't know they were really different things.
Really? This is I'm kind of surprised because
they're the same concept.
Well, there are global connections also between the Black Lives Matter movement and some of these other movements, including the Palestinian movement. And so I thought maybe that's what some of the language is coming from, but yeah, I mean,
well,
it's
Black Lives Matter does do a lot of, you know, pro-Palestinian defense because it's kind of is the same paradigm where you're got outside people controlling an other and treating them like an other, so not caring what happens to them, not caring that they live without resources, and then saying, look, we get terrorists out of them, and the same way they treat a Black community, saying, look, you get terrorists out of this Black community. Well, if you have no resources and you're being oppressed and stomped on and dehumanized, well, of course, this is the known result. So one of the more controversial things that I'll say is I'm pretty confident that we've had dramatic crime reductions in America, not because of policing, but rather in spite of policing through the incredible hard work of public health.
How do you make that connection?
Well, let's say the biggest correlate we have to violent crime reduction is lead poisoning abatement. It's the most dramatic one that you can see. When you go back and you look at the lead poisoning abatement that started in the 70s, when the lead goes down in the populace, 20 years later, you'll see the violent crime rate go down on the exact same slope. So,
that's fascinating. I had no
we
idea.
We are not focusing on symptoms, because if we were focusing on symptoms, the strongest correlate we have is lead poisoning. So if cops cared about fighting violent crime intelligently, they would actually be fighting the lead poisoning that's in our communities like Flint. So in Flint, you're right, going to have an increase of violent crime 20 years from now by following the lead poisoning.
And I mean, I'm sure you can go really deep into this, but I'm going to do a little research after we get off about the impact of lead poisoning on human behavior. I mean, is that what you're suggesting? Or you're just...
Yeah, it totally is, without question.
Wow, I had no idea. And Michael, I've heard that you are working on a podcast now, developing a podcast with a team that's going to really illuminate some of the issues that you've been working on for the last couple of years. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, another thing that I learned from getting involved in the community and getting that lesson of what can we do with you, or what do you need us to do? One of the biggest things that we need is structure and platforms. So I'm going to admit a bit of arrogance or something, that I didn't think that the young members of the Black Lives Matter movement that are in their, you know, early 20s and the other people that are surrounding them, I didn't think they understood these issues, because like I was the cop, I was the one that got the education, but these guys and girls, they understand the issues. They know exactly what they need and they understand the problems. So all they need is a platform and the support to actually step up. All we need to do is actually supply a bootstrap. They don't actually have the bootstraps. So if we want to help, we have to supply the bootstrap and give them that platform. And so one of the ideas that we've had is to build this podcasting network and build a studio that, well, your brother and I try and step up and actually make happen, where our community members and our activists can have the resources and the platform that they all just show up and they can get their voices heard and they can get their ideas out there. And then we can all learn what it is that they need from us, instead of us telling them what we're going to do for them. And inside of all of that, we're going to use that sensationalism that came from what was bad is what we're going to use to bring people in and to get recognition for the show. And I'll start doing podcasting on the show along with your brother, and we'll have some really good podcasts that are focusing on these types of conversations. And I think we're probably going to end up starting with breaking down what happened in Freddie Gray's murder.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple of conversations with you and my brother about kind of this community accessible studio to do what podcast shows, music, whatever. And I think it's just a phenomenal idea. For people who are interested, they definitely should follow you and my brother Saad Chaudhry on Twitter, because I see you guys routinely. You're saying that you are going to be starting off with a podcast on the Freddie Gray case. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think we all have a misunderstanding of like what's going on in this case, and the news reports conflict. The prosecutors don't seem to be prosecuting, and the defense doesn't really seem to be defending sometimes. It's a really baffling case. So I think a good idea to increase all of our understanding, and this includes me in this ballgame that really doesn't understand what's going on in that case, is to really break it down and to give it some serious nuance. There's a lot of people that will think that Freddie Gray is just a drug dealer, and whatever happened to him, he shouldn't have gotten himself into that. And we really need to tell the story of why Freddie Gray is in that neighborhood, why Freddie Gray isn't just him. He represents everybody in those type of neighborhoods, and what the policing history has done to lead us to this point, and really break down each step of this so that we all can reflect as a community on what our policies and decisions are actually resulting in, because it is policy and law that resulted in Freddie Gray being in the back of that van, meeting his death, and a police department leaning on the legality to get away from responsibility. All that needs to be broken down. I think it's a good microcosm of the systemic problem in policing that we can look at and see how that can destroy lives, and ends up policing not being a thing of service, but being a thing that is actually keeping communities down and maybe in contributing to the crime rate.
I didn't think about it like that, but you're right. I think Freddie Gray is like a really on point, really case study that illustrates all of the issues that we've talked about in the last hour, and also brings us full circle, because we began today's discussion with Freddie Gray. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to that. Can you give us a little bit of a time frame for our listeners? Like, when can we expect that podcast to come out? Is it going to be a series, or how are you planning on covering it?
We do plan on doing a series and to get it out there by the end of the year, for sure.
I think that's an amazing kind of framework and perspective on how to tackle the case. I really look forward to it. And, you know, we're here to support you all the way. I'm just going to end up by asking, how can people find you, whether it's Twitter, website, email, whatever you want to share, so our listeners can follow you, get in touch with you?
Sure. I try extremely hard to be approachable and answer as many questions as I can. So I have my DMs open on Twitter, so people can instant message me, and that is at Michael A. Wood Jr., but Jr. as a JR. And the website is just my name too, michaelawoodjr.net. And you can always reach out from there or find all the resources there. And if you want to find Saad, or they want to find you or whoever this goes, there's only a matter of time following me before they see that interaction.
I look forward to your work, and thanks for everything you're doing to help make change in this country. Appreciate you coming on, Michael.
Thank you. I'm honored to be your friend.
Thanks, me too. Now, last week we had announced that we would be featuring in one of these bonus episodes an interview with attorney Dean Strang, who was made infamous through the series Making a Murder because he represented Stephen Avery many years ago. But due to some scheduling difficulties, we had to shuffle things around a bit. Don't worry, though. We are going to still bring you a great interview with Mr. Strang, but it'll just be a little bit later this year. Next week is going to be our last bonus episode before the launch of the new season on July 11th. Now, if you've been paying attention, you probably heard the exciting news that Emmy Award-winning actor John Cryer will be joining us in season 2. That confused some people. They didn't understand the connection. The connection runs deep, though, and it runs through someone else you are all probably very familiar with, Bob Ruff. Next week on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.